When it comes to ensuring your company has top-notch security practices, things can get complicated fast. With Vanta, you can automate compliance for SOC 2, ISO 27001, HIPAA, and more. Vanta's market-leading trust management platform can help you unify security program management with a built-in risk register and reporting, and streamline security reviews with AI-powered security questionnaires. Over 7,000 fast-growing companies like Atlassian, Flow Health, and Quora use Vanta to manage risk and prove security in real time. You can watch Vanta's on-demand video at vanta.com/decoder to learn more. That's vanta.com/decoder.
This episode is brought to you by State Farm. If you're a small business owner, you know that it isn't just your business, it's your life. And whatever your business might be, you want someone who understands. That's why you might want to check out State Farm Small Business Insurance. Why? Because State Farm agents are small business owners too, living and working in your community. That means they know what it takes to help you personalize your policies for your small business needs. Like a good neighbor, State Farm is there. Talk to your local agent today.
Hello and welcome to Decoder. I'm Neelai Patel, editor-in-chief of The Verge, and Decoder is my show about big ideas and other problems. If you've spent more than 2 minutes somewhere on social media, you have probably come across Gary Vaynerchuk.
There's a secret that you don't know about decisions. It's called, you wouldn't have known the alternative, and so it doesn't fucking matter.
And for years, I have wondered, is this just a character? Or is there a real Gary Vaynerchuk somewhere behind Gary V, the social media entrepreneur and internet brand? Gary got his start working at his family's liquor store, which he turned into an online wine shop. That's where he started in social media, hosting a long-running YouTube show called Wine Library TV. He parlayed that into the gigantic Gary V brand, which at its core is about entrepreneurship. Gary himself co-founded the restaurant reservation platform Resy, which he sold to American Express in 2019, and Empathy Wines, which he sold in 2020. But the Vaynerchuk empire remains vast, and it's structured in complicated ways. There's a holding company called VaynerX, which contains the ad agency VaynerMedia. There's another company called Gallery Media, which owns lifestyle websites.
Then there's the Sasha Group, named after my father. That's a agency for SMBs. So we're getting so much inbound, especially given my career, more mom and pop businesses, not the Pepsis and the Chase.
Wine shops. Gary even co-founded a sports agency called Vayner Sports, which has pro athletes like the NFL's Kirk Cousins and Sauce Gardner on the roster, as well as MLB shortstop Bo Bichette and a variety of combat athletes. So how does Gary manage all of this? He's responsible for so many things. How does he make decisions? Is it all just a character? And honestly, how does he stay so positive all the time? Is that the character or is that the real Gary V? On top of all that, there's serious upheaval going on in digital media. The era of the social web is coming to a major moment of change, with new platforms like TikTok in the mix and old standbys like Twitter and Reddit going through complicated and controversial resets. New platforms bring new personalities and influencers who are native to those platforms and maybe better at capturing the audience there. It's one thing when you're the first Gary V, but staying Gary V in a time of change in pitching brands and companies that his approach to social media will stay relevant is an ongoing challenge. I got to talk about all this with Gary at his office in Hudson Yards in Manhattan, and I will tell you, he did not hold back with his answers. This one was a ride. I did my best to hang on. It's pretty fun. Okay, Gary Vaynerchuk, Gary V. Here we go. Gary Vaynerchuk, also known as Gary V, head of VaynerX, the advertising holding agency, YouTuber. You have a lot of things. Welcome to Decoder.
Thanks for having me.
Decoder is a show about structure and process and decision making, and you have the most of that from what I can tell. You just have a lot going on. Let's start at the very beginning. How are your companies structured? How does that work?
VaynerX that you just mentioned, that a lot of people don't know about, you know, they see the Gary V of it all, but they don't realize that there's an 1,500, 1,600 person global company. VaynerX The main company is VaynerMedia, the company I started in 2009 with my brother AJ. That's the advertising agency. That's the Mad Men, Madison Avenue thing. And then the next biggest companies in VaynerX are the Gallery Media Group, which houses purewow.com and 137 PM. So that's publishing. There's Vayner3, which is an innovation strategy company, AI, blockchain, VR, QR. That's more like a Bain & McKinsey company. Avery runs that. That's going well. Vayner Speakers, a speaking bureau. Zach runs that. Then there's VFriends. I've always wanted to buy a intellectual property. So I used to think I was going to buy the Flintstones or Gumby or the Smurfs. The NFT thing came. I'm like, wait a minute. This is a place to launch it. I launched VFriends a couple years ago. So that's my intellectual property business grounded in blockchain, but also expanded to the real world. VCon, my big conference that's coming up, is part of that. And then there's a little tiny room these days, though it's been a big chapter of the last decade, of the Gary Vee of it all, right? Yeah. You know, all my content. I'm really not public speaking anymore. I am writing a new book, but it's taken me a little while with how busy I am and all the content creation and the podcast. So yeah, I'm busy.
Yeah. So you mentioned VaynerX, 1,600 people. That's the big holding company. Yes. That's got the ad agency in it, a bunch of other stuff. Then you mentioned some companies that are not part of it. How do you decide what's in, what's out? What's in VaynerX, what's not in VaynerX?
For all the people that are watching that have two or more children, they know that you're only as happy as your most unhappy child. And so, especially for the people watching who have like five or six children, you know, the reality is you're ebbing and flowing. And so when you're a captain of a boat, you don't know where the holes are going to be. So the reality is that I do view, you know, VFriends and VaynerX as the two cores, but there are moments when AJ needs me on Vayner Sports. There's going to be moments as Eric Wattenberg builds out our production company where I'm going to have to fly to LA and pitch a show for a big opportunity on Netflix. You know, it's going to happen. So I decide based on two chiefs of staff and three admins whose full-time job is to take all the inbound that comes in my text and my Slack and my email and strategize. We spend a lot of time during the week thinking about the 3 weeks ahead. We're always, you know, lots of 15-minute meetings instead of 30, trying to make a lot happen. And then it's almost like being in the news business. You know, like all of you, you have your editorial strategy, but then, you know, it's like in the sports media business, you have your strategy for today, and then Aaron Rodgers gets traded to the Jets officially, and that's going to change up.
Yeah.
And that's what being an operator at a high level, I think, with multiple things going on, is I have my strategy for this week, but anything can happen in the next hour that blows out 3 hours, and then those 3 hours have to get back in the books because those are top 5% things in a world of a million things being thrown at you. And so it's a constant flow.
How much do you delegate? You said you had five people. Are they actually in your Slack? Your admins have like full Slack access to your DMs?
Scarier than that. My admins have access to everything.
Yeah.
My iCloud, my email. I live a transparent life with my admins. Like, you know, they're signed into all my social. Yeah, I keep it very transparent with them because I need to be able to navigate quickly and they need all the data points. So I delegate tremendously.
Yeah.
I don't think you really can. I would argue that for a lot of people listening or watching, all of their limitations on the growth of the things they're operating, by the way, whether that's a family that you're operating and not delegating enough to the oldest child or to a friend or an aunt or a grandparent, or if you're running a business or like me, many, many, many businesses, delegation, trust, the lack of ego of thinking you do everything the best is an incredible thing that I most look at when I'm trying to help a friend, family member, or an investment to figure out why they're not scaling.
When you think about delegation, there's the admins, then you've got companies, you've got people running your companies. How do you decide, okay, these are the people who are going to be in charge of this company inside of VaynerX, and this company needs to be outside of VaynerX with a different leadership structure?
Outside of VaynerX has been easy. Steve Ross, the owner of the Dolphins, is a business partner of ours and couldn't own a piece of this sports agency, so we spun that out. And then with Vayner Sports and Vayner Watt are the only things outside of the company. Vayner Watt, because Eric needed to be such a significant partner, it needed to sit out of the structure. But most things will go into VaynerX if they're in that service world. The way I really decide that is pretty simple. I either really know or I really don't know. And let me explain. Avery, who runs Vayner 3, or Jeannie, who runs Vayner Toronto, they were executives that were here 3, 4, 5 years doing great work that made me confident to send Avery to APAC or Jeannie up to Toronto. Then there's guessing. I made a subjective guess on Gabby, who runs LATAM in Mexico City. I made a subjective guess on Daisy, who'd been in for a couple of months to take over EMEA, UK, Europe. And then in those scenarios, you go in optimistic, you go in focused on trying to help them. And then in a 12, 18, 24, 36 month window, you're making a final decision if you made the right call.
Are you telling them, here are the metrics I'm judging you on, make the number go up?
Not really. I'm really, yes, they can't go out of business.
Yeah.
But I'm a little, you know, I'm not publicly held company. I'm not looking to exit. So, you know, I'd like them to be fiscally responsible. They can't be completely aloof. But I would argue that what I most focus on is, like, if you do not have the people that work for you, and I mean all of them, not your direct reports, incredibly happy with you, feeling safe. I think when you have a people-based business, if you don't understand how disproportionate culture is, I think you'll lose. I really do. And what I mean by losing is there's unbelievable amounts of businesses out there that are winning financially that don't have good culture. It's not good. It's toxic. It's not good. It's anxious. It's, it doesn't even need to be toxic or that serious. It's just not great. It's like a job. It's like whatever. You know, for me, those companies are missing out on top line revenue and profit. And so, you know, I think for me, I'm telling all of them, get everyone feeling safe because there's so much fear in the world, and get everyone understanding how unique the marketing strategies we have are, or in VeeFriends, what we're actually up to, or whatever company it is, Vayner Sports, how well we are in marketing off the field. Get the core messages down and understand them, but most importantly, build a safety, happy, accountable, but happy place. I call it honey empire. Honey over vinegar, but we're trying to build an empire. That's, you know, this is not for fun. And so those are the metrics. And that is a struggle for people on the outside. Everyone out here, these big buildings, is being trained to win on the P&L, not on the culture.
So this is actually my next question.
Please. Right?
So you've got a big holding company. You've got lots of empowered executives.
Yes.
We talk a lot on this show about divisional structures versus functional structures. A lot of tech companies are functional, right? Tim Cook runs marketing and he runs product and it all rolls up to him. And at the end of the day, they somehow produce an iPhone. Other companies are divisional, right? You've got just a stack and you've got some redundant functions in them. How is VaynerX structured? Is
a little bit of a mix of the two.
Yeah.
You know, the reality is I do a lot of casting on leaders. You know, what's interesting is we're a 13-year-old company. VaynerMedia, VaynerX is even younger. That happened when I bought PureWow. We started building it 6 years ago. A lot of this has to do with, you know, HQ, the VaynerX of it all, has its leaders. But we keep that pretty thin and we give a lot of power to the leaders of divisions and companies. But you are micromanaging and creating redundancy while you're, it's almost like a kid riding a bike. You've got to give them training wheels, especially if they're from the outside. When I bring in new leaders from the outside, I'm going to create some cushions. You know, just because the reality is we do it very differently, both the craft and the culture. And so once someone is able to like cross over the hill, then I think we can make it, you know, far more autonomy based. But I like to be close to people that have enormous amounts of control, though I have no interest in micromanaging them. So I'm in the business of bat phone. I'm in the business of making them feel safe.
Did you say bat phone?
Bat phone.
So there's a crisis you gotta call Gary?
Even more.
You have a special bat phone?
No, everyone has the same number, but it's you know, it's funny. It's not, yes, crisis. It's more like just keep me close, use me. You know, so many of these leaders, actually, ironically, we had a global offsite yesterday. So many of them want to prove to me they can do it. And I keep telling them, hey, I know you can do it. The problem is you've been doing it for 20 years on the outside. There's 7,300 nuances here. Text me and ask.
Yeah.
Like, I'm not judging you. I'm here to help you. I work for you. But outside executives struggle with that. They don't believe me. And it sometimes takes 3 to 5 years for me to break through of like, I'm not kidding. Like, you're not going to get fired by missing your numbers, but you definitely become vulnerable if people aren't happy. And the quickest way for people to not be happy is for you to be scared of me and it, which then trickles down.
Do people use your name to get what they want? I feel like at a company that's called VaynerX, run by Gary Vaynerchuk.
You mean executives with each other?
Gary wants this. Is that happening?
I'm sure. Yeah. I'm sure that's happening. the cool thing is, as a 13-year company, we have almost 100 people that have been here for 9 years or longer. Mm-hmm. We have crazy retention. And I think what's awesome about that, when I hear this, I would say 6-7 years ago, probably a lot more than today, there's too many people entrenched in too many places that know the truth of it all, that it's almost like been, it's almost like a double negative. Like there's so many family members in so many different places that I think it doesn't, it's harder to get away with that. But I'm sure that happens every day.
Yeah, I'm always just curious, especially when your name's on the door.
What's cool is I have such an aggressive open door policy that ironically, the junior people use me more than the senior people at times. And so a lot of people are comfortable, even like a year in, only meeting with me once, but based on everything that they know, to email me and be like, hey, my boss's boss said this. Is this true? And I'm like, no or yes. Like, yeah. You know, it's I couldn't encourage leaders that are listening here more on finding as many 5 and 10 minute slots to say hello to a new employee. Like just that breaking the ice of it all is massive.
This brings me to, I think, the decoder question you're describing, right? This process you have where you make big long-term strategy, you have a vision, and then you're very reactive to things that are happening to you, incoming information all along. How do you make decisions?
So I'll answer that. And I love how you put that. I literally operate on macro patience and micro speed. I make decisions based on a lot of things. One, my intuition. I really do believe that I think a lot about what do we know today that people didn't know 100 years ago? A ton about the body, the mind. I always ask myself, what are people gonna know 100 years from now that we don't know today? My favorite running thesis right now is that we don't talk enough about the gut, the intuition, the operating system that this is. We know this is. But we don't talk enough about this. And so my big guess in 100 years is this is understood a lot more and is like a normal part of life.
Intuition, you mean?
That's right.
Not your like microbiome.
Both, by the way, ironically. Yeah, it's funny, right. I was about to say that, but that's exactly right. Both, actually. How much of an impact on your life this is. So intuition is very big. Pattern recognition is enormous. For the 23-year-olds, harder. For everybody who's 45 and older, massive. Experience matters. These gray hairs start to add up, right? They do have value. And so pattern recognition. Number three, a complete, utter focus on intent and lack of fear. Mm-hmm. Every decision I make, I know has good intent, truly. Thus rendering me very confident that if there's ramifications or I made a misstep, that the apology is always there, that the correction is there, the vulnerability, the humility. I'm not scared of making a wrong call. And I think that's a huge part of my decisions. And then tons of data. The reason I want the bat phone, which is really more just check in and let's keep talking, is I can make fast decisions when I'm sitting on a lot of information. And so I'm talking to all my employees all the time, virtually, through text or in person, mainly to make me have the ability to go fast in the future. One of my biggest beliefs is that most CEOs don't spend enough time judging the judgers. I am judging my 40, 50 most senior people on how much I value their word blindly, like Marcus and Hannah, my chiefs of staff who I'm looking at across the window right now, because they've been here for 9 and 13 years, or less, but a road to it for an executive that's maybe running a company or an office that's only been here for 2 or 3 years. I can't be blindly with them yet. I don't have enough data, but that's the framework I work in.
So I'm just talking to you here in person. You're very animated, you're very charming, you're very direct. I have discovered that when I'm very direct in digital communication, I come off like a huge jerk. How do you do all the things you do and communicate digitally with your team?
I don't communicate digitally.
You don't, you're not slacking, you're not.
I do, but I'm petrified of it.
Yeah.
I tell everyone, if it's something real, get out of text. The misinterpretation of the written word digitally is a monster. People will consume it based on their framework. Or when I do it and I have to give any level of direct, I'm coming with a heart emoji and a sun right behind it. I do that a lot because I'm petrified that someone's losing the tone. We had Cole just joined our team. He just joined our WhatsApp where my team works on our content. He doesn't know me.
Yeah.
And if I've got something to say right now, he might think on his first day, like, wait a minute, Gary's actually full of shit. He's not as nice. Like, I need to put that heart emoji. I think people need to, the voice memo so they can hear my voice. I'm petrified to deliver even neutral to slightly candorous feedback in just written word. I think it's a massive mistake. I have completely gotten my leadership team off of the long email that's talking about like, today we've had to like, I mean, I'm like, it's crazy. You're scaring people. When I'm being direct, which is, by the way, ironically, Gary Vee in interviews, my content, great at candor. Gary Vaynerchuk, the executive, has struggled historically with candor.
Yeah.
I hate negativity. I've always seen candor as something that would scare people. I had it misunderstood for the majority of my career. So I call it kind candor. You need to, if you're delivering candor, you need to be empathetic that the other person on the other side is not going to feel great. Even if it's like truly fair, they're still going to feel bad about themselves. So why not have compassion and try to make them feel a little bit better by referencing something you've struggled with or just fixing the tone. So I think about that a lot.
Yeah, I always think about it in terms of you can tell people it's okay to feel bad and then you can work through it together. But that first step is really hard.
Yeah, or you could really put it on yourself as a leader and try to make them feel less bad.
Yeah.
Like there's absolutely a way to make someone feel slightly less bad when you're telling them that they're not good at their job.
We have to take a quick break. We'll be back in a second with Gary Vaynerchuk.
Support for today's show comes from Deloitte. Here's the story of innovation told in five words. Try. Explore. Connect. Pivot. Transform. See what happened there? As soon as Connect entered the story, innovation became achievable. That's why Deloitte works with clients and tech alliances to bring together the people, ideas, and technologies to overcome, solve, and of course, transform. Connect to what matters for innovation. Start at Deloitte.com/US/innovate.
Support for this podcast comes from Hims. It can be challenging for men to speak about their health, and whether that's a fear of being vulnerable or just wanting to keep things private, there are just some things we would just rather keep to ourselves. Hims knows how you feel, which is why they're looking to provide you the help you need discreetly. Hims is a men's healthcare brand looking to provide simple and convenient access to science-backed treatments for men. The entire process is 100% online, so you can get a new routine of improving your overall health in private. If prescribed, your medication ships directly to you for free and in discreet packaging. No waiting rooms and no pharmacy visits. So while it can be tough to deal with this part of your life, it doesn't mean you have to do it alone. Start your free online visit today at hims.com/decoder. That's hims.com/decoder for your personalized treatment options. hims.com/decoder. Prescriptions require an online consultation with a healthcare provider who will determine if appropriate. Restrictions apply. See hims.com/decoder for details and important safety information. Subscription required. Price varies based on product and subscription plan.
We're back with Gary Vee.
Let me talk about Gary Vee with you. You brought up this other character, Gary Vee versus Gary Vaynerchuk, the executive.
Yep.
The business of Gary Vee
seems
as complicated, as chaotic as anything. And it exists on social platforms,
which
are ever changing.
Yes.
We were talking to your team just before you sat down about just how much video of you is logged every single day.
Yes.
And what an enormous operation is. Is Gary Vee, that's a character you're playing?
No.
No.
Oh, it's me fully. Mm-hmm. It's just the context of the room is different. Right now, I know that we have a long-form video and audio execution, and I do believe that being slightly entertained or engaged, and this was something I did subconsciously when I first started speaking. I have intuitive understanding that you're more likely to get your message across if people actually pay attention.
Yeah, fair enough.
Right? So, no, I don't. There's nothing that I've ever put out on the internet that is shtick or fake. It's just that the context is different. If I'm having a company offsite that's trying to navigate a $350 million a year business, you can imagine with 15 people, that's going to be a very different tone and tenor yesterday than me doing a podcast on one of my favorite media platforms out there. Yeah. Like, I'm just going to be more excited. I know that somebody's running on the treadmill right now, walking their dog, driving in their car, and I want them to continue to hear the words. And if it's like super serious and mundane, that might not be the energy you're looking for. I'm also aware that my energy might be too much for someone. Yeah. This is like too hyper, and that's okay. This is just what naturally happens to me when there's cameras going. And so, no, it's not character life. It's just a slightly more animated version of myself, given that I get more excited when I think there's more people involved.
But when you have this many people following around with cameras, logging everything you say, ingesting it into what sounds like a very impressive Airtable system. You're a reality show, right? I mean, like you're kind of producing a daily reality show, and that naturally has to heighten whatever loudest characteristics you have.
I don't know about that. I'll explain. If you look, I would argue that YouTube is the platform that I do least well, mainly because I'm not overly passionate from a reality TV show standpoint, meaning I'm not trying to rate.
Mm-hmm.
I don't want the vlog to be overly successful from like winning an Emmy or getting a lot of viewers. I'd be fine with it. I'm trying to document way more than I'm trying to entertain. A big part of the vlog was done because I lost both my grandfathers before I got to know them, and I thought it would be neat that one day in 67 years, this would exist. I also knew that it would bring awareness and demand, but I really wanted it as a blueprint for people to see, like, this entrepreneur thing is not so fun. Like, it's not as easy as, it's not cool as it's become. And so, yeah, no, I don't, you know, there's, for example, there's nothing that I do day to day that has anything to do with the vlog.
Yeah.
It's just a documenting framework.
Well, I gotta ask you, do you ever turn it off?
Yeah.
When you think about the image you put out into the universe, I watch your TikToks. I love your TikToks. You're always talking to an audience.
Yes.
Right? It always seems like you're addressing some room.
Yes.
That's the majority of your content. Your audience does not see that you're just walking on the treadmill and you're happy that it's sunny outside or that you're quiet with your family. You have a very particular kind of image. Do you worry that you're leading people to believe that you're always on and that they should themselves always be on?
No, I don't worry about that at all. I think, for example, I think people find what they're looking for.
Mm-hmm.
Like I've been very aggressive of like, I don't want to share my personal life. I have tons of challenges. I speak about vulnerabilities. I'm a public figure. People know about my stuff. No, I really don't. I understand the question.
Yeah.
I think that it's time that we have a more thoughtful conversation around this. Meaning, I as a human, when I consume content at scale, never believe that any of the people that I'm consuming are showing you every single thing of their life, nor do I believe it's as good or as bad. I think that's a very lazy intellectual point of view.
But don't you have that point of view because you grew up with it? I mean, I grew up with the internet. I grew up with bloggers and YouTubers. But
go ahead.
It grew up with you, right? It didn't exist and it slowly has gotten to where it is now. And you've seen that whole transition. I think about our young audience. They're fish and they don't know about the water, right? They just grew up in a world where influencers exist, in a world where YouTubers exist, where being a YouTube star is a career path that you can tell your parents when you're 5 years old, right? And so you have this view where like, this isn't all real. And you're making the reality show. All of us are making the reality show. And you have an audience that doesn't know that it's a show.
Well, I think the way you framed it up is a little awkward. Let me explain. I think everything I show is real.
Yeah.
It's just not the complete part of my life. And there's certain things I decide not to share.
Yeah.
I also think when I think about this, when I was a kid, pre-internet, we looked up to stuff too.
Mm-hmm.
My entire high school, all the girls were in the bathroom throwing up because they all wanted to be Kate Moss and 80 pounds. Like this concept that, you know, my big question is, where's parenting in 2023?
Yeah.
I think that.
But you are that figure for a lot of people, young men in particular, you are that figure.
Yeah, but that is such an extraordinarily deep challenge, right? Like, you know, when I think of being someone that someone may look up to, I'm humbled by that. And so much of the way I create content understands that to be true.
Mm-hmm.
But I could never comprehend the complexity of actually being someone's parent or, you know, someone loses a parent and who replicates or fills that void. You look at that kind of from a human journey and there's many inputs that fill that void.
Yeah.
I think that's right. I do think that there's incredible intrigue that I have about the sheer volume of people that are putting out information in the world. But I feel like that has always been the game. Like there's an entire generation of boomers who live their life like Mickey Mantle because he was the one that they looked up to. So it's always existed. What I'm actually optimistic about is there's way more ways to look at things today.
Yeah.
And I think how people choose their paths is interesting.
All right, we'll be back after one more quick break. Stay tuned.
This episode is brought to you by State Farm. You've heard it before. Like a good neighbor, State Farm is there. But it's more than just a tagline, because State Farm agents are small business owners themselves who live and work in your community. And if you're in the market for small business insurance, who better to work with than an agent who understands what it takes? State Farm agents can help you create a personalized insurance plan that fits your small business needs and budget. Talk to your local State Farm agent today about small business insurance. Like a good neighbor, State Farm is there.
We're back with Gary Vaynerchuk.
You in particular are very good at using your experience to adapt to new platforms in particular,
yes,
from YouTube to Instagram to TikTok to NFTs, if that pans out.
Yep.
How do you think about that tension? All right, we're doing well on YouTube, but I got to take everything I know and go find a new audience on TikTok. Because this is something you talk about a lot. You got to jump when the time's right.
You got to jump when the time's right, if that's your ambition.
Mm-hmm.
You know, back to your point, which I thought was really great in the last series of questions. One of the things I talk a lot about, back to people hearing what they want to hear, is you need to be self-aware over everything and understand the journey you're on. So if you're a business and you want to grow your business, you have to go where the consumer attention is.
Mm-hmm.
That's just a requirement. So the way I think about it is, I am on my journey to try to build as much awareness as possible for the things that I'm passionate about. You know, for me, I enjoy my craft.
Yeah.
I enjoy my job and I want to do that. On the flip side, I'm very empathetic and talk a lot to the audience of like, hey, this happened huge 3-4 years ago. I'm like, TikTok, 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 TikTok. And everyone's like, dude, I'm just getting Instagram down. And I'm like, cool, you're more than welcome to not do it. You have to understand the attention's going to move there and
yeah,
you need to understand where you are on your journey. You can't be ideological about where you want the consumer attention is. You need to be where the consumer attention is.
Yeah. I guess the reason I ask you that is that constant change, that platform churn. I'm looking at the state of social media today. I'm looking at a bunch of YouTubers who are worried about burnout culture and they talk about it openly. I'm worried about a bunch of TikTokers who seem like they rose with the platform, got burned out, and they've kind of receded.
Yeah.
Right? That first wave of really big TikTokers, they've kind of pulled back.
But that's good, isn't it?
I wonder. It feels like being the most famous person on YouTube is no longer a great business.
Well,
and
it was never a great business being the most famous person. I mean, think about what we're dealing with. You and I grew up in an era where we knew that child stars, it was tough.
Yeah.
And so a lot of these kids get so much fame and money at such a young age, it's really hard to calibrate that.
But so you're coming at this from like a marketing perspective. That when you
yes,
talk about attention moving,
yes,
right? What I hear is, okay, this is a great marketer
yes,
who's saying, okay, I got to go send a message and we got to move to the platform, be native to
yes,
the platform. There is a generation of entrepreneurs who are like, this is my business. My business is making content. You know a bunch of
things. Of course.
And you go between those worlds, right? Gary Vee is a brand that makes content. That's a business. I'm sure it's monetized. If you're the world's best TikToker and you reach the peak, you're not making as much money as if you turn around and launch a merch line and stop making TikToks.
That
pattern to me seems really, it seems like the we're at the end of the road. Like everyone's realized the centralized social platforms are not stable foundations to build businesses. And they're—
Meaning if you're just monetizing as an influencer?
Yeah, if you're monetizing an influencer, or even if they're your core marketing platform.
Well, that would be like saying running commercials on Seinfeld is not sustainable. No shit.
Yeah.
Like once it's not got the attention, you have to move on.
Yeah.
So like as core marketing, I think it's crazy to not extract awareness from where it's actually being consumed.
Fair enough.
So that's that. To your point on the human element, that's a whole different game. That comes down to parenting and DNA.
Right.
Right? Like when I met the D'Amelios, I was like, oh, these girls are extremely fortunate. This is like a real dad and mom.
Yeah.
It's like my Vayner sports business. You know, do you know how many athletes grow up with nothing and then sign big contracts? And the ones that have self-awareness and stability do incredibly well with their money and their life. And the ones that don't become quite vulnerable. To your point, When you're a business, it's easier to move ebb and flow. When you're a human, there's going to be a natural time where you can't deal with the negative comments, the workload. Mm-hmm. But I view that more like the way we looked at like the Madonnas and Michael Jacksons and all those people in the 80s, which is, I think you'll see them ebb and flow. It was funny, I was listening to a Bruno Mars song this morning and like it was just in rotation on my Alexa. And I was like, what is Bruno Mars? Like he right now, and I was thinking, I'm like, oh, he's probably like chilling right now and like decompressing from world tour and all that fame. We've seen every single famous person over the last 40, 50 years. It's impossible to stay white hot forever because you're a human and you need to take a break. Yeah. I mean, I did 5 years of a wine show every day from 2006 to 2011 and was like really out and about and going. And then in 2011, from 2011 to 14, I made very little content building the foundation of this business. A, because this business was an opportunity, but B, because I was like, I don't want to make wine content every day. Yeah. My daily vlog, I did it every day for 3-4 years, filmed everything. The team will tell you right now with their head nods, we've been getting back into it. I don't want to film half the stuff because I'm out of rotation.
Yeah.
I'm like in this place and I think every human should be comfortable when they want to go for it. When they don't, they're going to be hot at certain times. They're not going to be hot. And what I mean by that is they themselves, they're going to be into it at times. They're not going to be into it at times. And I think the influencer business,
yeah,
I think is incredibly sustainable. I just don't think it's sustainable for every person every minute. And to your point, some of them have other entrepreneurial capabilities.
But that seems like the path out, right? It seems like once you find your way out to Prime, right, or whatever.
Yeah, but how many people are going to be able to be Emma Chamberlain, Logan Paul, and you know, and Mr. Beast?
Yeah.
Right? Like there's a lot of brands that have been started by a lot of people. Like, you know, when I did Empathy Wines years ago as a DTC brand, I knew that I could do it because I was an operator. A lot of these people are not actual operators or won't find a partner operator that's good.
Yeah.
And so I think that it's a and conversation, not an or.
Mm-hmm.
I think there'll be plenty of people that will continue to be a personal brand in perpetuity, just like there are celebrities who get paid to be celebrities in perpetuity. To your point, some of those celebrities, Jessica Alba, some of those celebrities, Reese Witherspoon, Ashton Kutcher, had DNA, Ryan Reynolds, Kevin Hart, The Rock. So I think it's going to be and for some people, but I do think the long tail of influencer is a sustainable business model. But to your point, I don't think every human, nor most humans, can do it forever. They'll ebb and flow and ebb and flow.
Yeah. Do you think that it's harder because the platform has changed so much?
I think it's easier.
You think it's easier to
what did we do?
If you're ebbing and flowing in one of your middle of your down period, everyone's attention moves from YouTube shorts.
What about when you ebbed and flow as John Travolta and then people decided they didn't want to give you a chance again? He was out of the game for 15 years.
But I mean, his business was selling acting services, right? If you're an influencer and you're making branded integrations with your YouTube videos, and suddenly that market disappears because all the attention's on TikTok.
But it
the
doesn't.
Core of your business.
But you know, you're speaking to a world that I don't think exists.
Okay.
Let's talk it through.
It.
Yeah, no, I think it's great.
Yeah.
Let's talk about it. In the last, what are we in 2023? In the last 17 years, how many of the biggest platforms have disappeared off the face of the earth? Vine, which was only 9 months old.
Yeah.
Right?
Dear Sweet Vine.
I know, it was so fun. A lot of these people came from that. That really, actually, if you look at Vine, I think Vine will be historically looked at very interestingly because it's what started short form video at that level. But if you really look at the last 17 years, YouTube, Facebook, Twitter, right? Instagram, Snapchat, TikTok, it's not like they've disappeared.
Yeah, but it seems like the users are like thinking about what's next, right? Like they're the business. Either way, you're correct. We've rarely seen platforms disappear.
I think
we have seen them lose relevance, right? And in particular, I think the mid-form YouTube video, the vlog, is like it used to be the gold standard. It's what everyone wanted to build, and now everyone wants to build TikToks.
I think the old media landscape was much harder to navigate because you had to be chosen by humans subjectively, and now with these platforms, they're empty pipes. And you as a human decide if you want to enter, if you want to be good at it, if you don't, ebb and flow, in and out. And I think that that's good as long as the human is self-aware and doing the right things by themselves.
How do you bring this all to your clients? Again, which are the VaynerX, the biggest company is VaynerMedia, it's the ad agency.
Yes.
A lot of the clients now, the internet is not a foreign concept. Right. And platforms are not a foreign concept. When you started, it was, right?
Yes.
This is a very new pitch that you're
making.
Now there are other great ad agencies that are native to the space. What's your pitch? How do you go and make business?
Our point of view is that we're the best at today. Mm-hmm. We think the industry cares about yesterday. Mm-hmm. Way too much television commercials, programmatic banners, all the kind of old world. We think they're also too bullish on tomorrow.
Mm-hmm.
You know, even though I was very bullish and continue to be on NFTs, the macro, we had clients who wanted to build $1 million metaverses last year. And I was like, are you out of your mind? There's like four people in the metaverse.
Yeah.
So they get excited about tomorrow. They're way too religious about yesterday. And our pitch is like, we're the best of today. We do the media buying and the creative, the strategy behind that creative for the 10 platforms, LinkedIn, Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, Snapchat, TikTok, Pinterest. When we get the consumer insights out of that creative, the quant and qual data, the numbers and the comments, it allows us to have a better brief. I'm pointing to that because usually it's about that long of a brief to then make the longer form videos that are modern day commercials. We want to make the commercials that are going to be strong on Hulu, connected TV, fast channels. And so that's our pitch. We're an ad agency that just thinks that television ads are overpriced and bad digital is overpriced and you should do today's best. And social happens to be that now. But if I started VaynerMedia in 1997, it would have been email. And then in 2000, we would have gone into search. And in 2041, we may be completely out of social because maybe the attention is on VR or metaverse. I'm very agnostic. I'm not overly passionate where the attention is. Back to the TikTok thing. Yeah. Gary, what happens if TikTok's banned? I'm like, we'll go where the... I have no emotion towards Twitter or TikTok or Facebook or Instagram. What I do have emotion to, what you mentioned earlier, is as long as I'm acting in my professional life, I understand that attention matters. I'd like to understand where the best price is to get that attention.
Yeah.
And I'd like to be good at bringing value with the videos, words, and content, because I know that that always will work for the business if they're providing value.
You talk about attention like a commodity, like you can price it and sell it.
Yes.
It's pretty ruthless, actually. Like in a, just a, from a business sense, you're talking about like you're trading oil or gold or something.
Yeah.
I am a news person.
Yes.
I think about attention a very different way.
Yes.
I watched one of your TikToks the other day. It was, you were telling people how to make great content. And you're like, if you got a thought, just Google it, find an article, green screen yourself in front of the article. This is how you can capture attention on TikTok. And I thought, one, that's brilliant. And I told our team to start doing that with articles.
Yeah.
And then two, I thought, this is the scariest shit I ever heard. Because now we're trading on other people's trust that there's a news article, but we're just doing it to harvest attention.
Well, that's
right? And that ruthless side of it where we're just harvesting attention, I feel like there's a danger there.
Well, I think that's what the news does.
Do you feel like you have a responsibility to use the attention you harness positively, constructively?
Because
if you're
way.
Pretty ruthless, there are other people who don't feel that way, right? Who are just after it for traffic, who are just after it for clicks, who are just after it for attention.
Yeah.
And you're right on the precipice where you talk about it like a commodity, but I know you, and I know you feel that responsibility. What is that responsibility for you?
I want to be historically correct. I want to feel good when I put my head on the pillow. I want to talk about the things I'm passionate about.
Yeah.
I don't need to make my money. I don't monetize that attention directly the way media does. I monetize that from awareness if people are interested in the things that I do. And then there's secondary realities of like, here's a book, or people come and see me speak, thus rendering my speaking fee high, or I make a wine and I'm like, hey, I think this is a better $20 wine. And that attention gives me the opportunity to ask for an opportunity. I do think attention is the most important commodity in the world. I don't think of it like, I bought it for a dollar and sold it for a dollar too. I think of it as like, when you have your children before they're 18, that attention is everything in the framing of how they're going to live their life. And you better take advantage of the attention. When you're a business person, if you get attention, you get a chance to tell people about your products and services. It doesn't mean they're going to buy it. I actually think one of the biggest issues of people who go patient with attention is they expect people to buy stuff from them after they've done a good job by getting the attention in a good way.
Yeah.
And I always tell them, you're not entitled to them buying anything. You're entitled to getting a chance for them to know about it. So that's how I think about it.
Let's end with VFriends. VFriends is maybe the ultimate example of you have a lot of attention on yourself.
Yes.
And you sold a product to consumers.
Yes.
In a way that, apart from the wine, I don't think you've sold a lot of
products.
Correct.
Those are the two moves. Sneakers a little bit, books a little bit.
And I hear you on, you've always wanted to have IP. So you found a technological opening to create an IP franchise. NFTs were pretty weird in that moment, right? They were pretty bubbly. People were buying them way too high.
Yes.
The market has crashed.
Yes.
Do you have any regrets about that whole situation?
Not really, because... I mean, micro regret, you know, like I made a ton of videos of 99% of these NFTs are going to zero.
Yeah.
And I made a ton of that at the height. So that's why I'm able to answer not really, because I was talking about it in a very macro way. The other thing was, it was important for me to make my NFTs be a part of something that was physical. So VeeFriends Series 1 came with 3 tickets to a super business conference called VeeCon that the price of the mint was worth the conference in itself.
Yeah.
So, and then Series 2 came with trading cards that have created a lot of demand on eBay and things of that nature. So I feel macro good. Of course, there's a million things you want to do a little bit better of getting overexcited during moments along the way.
Mm-hmm.
But I'm really glad, back to like, do I feel a responsibility on making content?
Yeah.
When VeeFriends came out, one, in May of 21, it was a very young market. It kind of, and then things went bananas.
Right.
So in August and September and October of that year, I started changing my content to, hey, this is something you need to learn about, to, hey, 99% of these are going to zero. Like, to your point, where NFTs are in the macro pricing, not the technology, the products, that the beanie babies of it all, not stuffed animals are going to be here for 100 years, the beanie babies and the garbage pail kids of it all, right? People come up to me like, what? I'm like, look, like, this was always about the macro technology, and there was unlimited content of 99% are going to zero, but people will hear what they want. During that time when I was
Well, because they're paying you money for a thing, right?
Well, but that was long. You have to say, they paid money for a thing in May.
Right.
Which, again, came with physical items, and the NFT was
that, so that's a reframing, right? So now the value is the physical items, the value.
Wasn't a reframing. If you go watch all the, like, it really wasn't. It was, there's a collectible. I will spend 50 years trying to build this IP. Let's see what happens if I'm capable.
Yeah.
Comma, here is the conference that comes with it, and this is how it's priced. So, you know, the good news is, like, one great thing about documenting everything and doing this all the time is it's there.
Yeah.
It's there. I also have the benefit of, like, genuinely believing that I'm going to make people fall in love with Optimistic Otter and Patient Panda. And that becomes a Marvel and Pokemon journey over the next 2 decades. And this goes, you know, you really touched on something so important for me. What's the person's intent?
Mm-hmm.
You know, you said, do you have a responsibility in your content? Yes. That's why I put out what I put out. Do I have a responsibility to make this a big thing? I sure do. A lot of people want to believe that I'm going to be able to pull it off, and I believe I'm going to be able to pull it off. So I think the intent and then the actions, because you can't just have intent, is going to become what everyone is judged on. And I take that stuff serious.
What do you think the timeline for VeeFriends, and then to use your word, macro for NFTs, is to become serious, to become meaningful?
Well, I mean, Series 1 is meaningful now. It's dramatically above, even with an 80%, 90% decline, massively above what people paid for it.
Okay.
But to your point, 10, 12, 8, you know, I think a lot about
years.
Yeah. It's just going to take time. Like, to get millions of people to care about, you know, Rare Robot. And, you know, I've got a, you know, I started a TV production company to do animation.
Mm-hmm.
I signed a kids book deal. You know, we've done toys already with Macy's and Toys R Us. Like, it's just a lot of work, right? It takes time. You know, but, you know, I think what's cool about NFTs is when you bring utility in the smart contract, that was always what gave me peace of mind. To your point, empathy, selling wine, peace of mind. When you're selling $40 wine for $20, people are going to like it. VeeFriends, what gave me peace of mind was the collectible cards, the access, and then the super conference. And then the access that comes along the way, like different mini events, Burn Island, all these, you know, I'm working on it every day. You know, meaningful comes in a lot of different ways. For a far majority of the audience, it's already been ROI meaningful, and now the collectible sits there as a added value. For others, to your point, that maybe bought it at higher prices when all the hype, I still got a lot of work for them probably to be fulfilled because they didn't buy at the mint price.
Yeah.
And so, you know, that's something I need to work on forever.
I guess I'm at meaningful in the sense that it's an NFT, but NFTs are the technology that enabled you to introduce the IP.
You mean the macro NFT? Got it.
Right. But the idea that we're out there buying and selling NFT collectibles is not a mainstream idea, right? It was a very bubbly idea, but it's far from mainstream. When do you think it goes mainstream?
10 to 12. I think that's, I think because they're going to be about utilities. It's more like, you know, one of the analogies I used all the time was ticket stubs.
Yeah.
Like, you go on eBay right now, you will hit the ground. Every Phish concert, every sporting event, like, just unlimited ticket stubs. Similar with NFTs. I think all tickets to Madison Square Garden over there in a decade are going to be NFTs. Like, to me, nothing changes the way people collect. Like, the reason I thought 99% would go to zero is because 99% of sports cards are zero. 99% of comic books are zero. The 1% get real interesting. Jordan rookie, Spider-Man number one. So I think 10 years, I think VR, you know what's interesting? AI is going to speed up a lot of the Web3 movement. I think the way that's going to play out. that's another show for it. We'll be back for that show.
Gary, you've given us way more time than anticipated. Thank you so much.
Thanks for having me. Talk soon.
Thanks again to Gary Vaynerchuk for taking time to talk today. And thank you for listening to Decoder. I hope you enjoyed it. As always, I'd love to hear what you think of Decoder. You can email us at decoder@theverge.com. I read all the emails. And you can hit us up directly on TikTok. Check it out. It's at DecoderPod. We're having a lot of fun with it. If you like Decoder, please share it with your friends and subscribe wherever you get your podcasts. If you really like the show, hit us with that 5-star review. Decoder is a production of The Verge and part of the Vox Media Podcast Network. Today's episode was produced by Jackie McDermott and Raghu Manavalan. It was edited by Kelly Wright. The Decoder music is by Breakmaster Cylinder. Our editorial director is Brooke Minters, and our executive producer is Eleanor Donovan. We'll see you next time.